Okay. Good morning. Good morning. All right. Today we're doing an introduction to Kabbalah. Right? That's my understanding of this class. Kabbalah. 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 Right. I know. So if Madonna was teaching the class, it would be Kabbalah. But I'm teaching it, so it's Kabbalah.
And by the way, she'd have red strings instead of paper.
She would have red strings.
I'm just saying.
Because she wouldn't be teaching, she'd be teaching Kabbalah, which is different than Kabbalah. So we will be learning about Kabbalah, as differentiated from the popular form. Okay.
Are we worthy enough to do that?
That's a great question. So are we worthy enough to do that? And should I be teaching it? I'm a female, turns out. Right? So really, in the Ashkenazic tradition, to start learning Kabbalah, you should be male, 40, and have learned the entire Torah and Talmud. Right? So that wipes us all out. Okay? So, but fortunately, I had a Sephardic rabbi, among many, and he told me I should start learning Kabbalah. And I was in my 30s, I think early 30s at the time. And I said, really? I said, don't you have to be like really learned and male? He said, oh, that is the Ashkenazim. The Ashkenazim, they're so pessimistic. He was so upset. He was great. He was from Morocco. And he was fabulous with that. He'd say, all the customs of the Jews are all beautiful customs, but the customs of Moroccans are the most beautiful. So that was Rabbi Abitan. Aleph HaShalom. Anyway, I am not a Kabbalist. I don't know Kabbalah, but I have learned about Kabbalah, and I've learned some close to Kabbalistic things. We're just going to learn pretty much what Kabbalah is, and maybe like a little drip and drop. So I'm sure some of you have heard some of this. I just want to organize the ideas for you a little bit. So first of all, what does Kabbalah mean, the word Kabbalah? I gave a whole class on Kabbalah one time, and somebody came over afterwards disgruntled that I never defined the word. So we'll start with that. So Kabbalah means receive, or received tradition. So lekabel is to receive something. Kabbalah, today, in modern Hebrew, is a receipt. So you get a Kabbalah. When you pay your bill, you get a Kabbalah. So Kabbalah also means Kabbalah. That's the Ashkenazic pronunciation. It should be Kabbalah. In modern Hebrew or in Sephardic pronounced Hebrew. So what is that? So we have here the written Torah, right? And we all know that along with this, we got an oral Torah. So imagine it's like a doctor's prescription, right? So when the doctor prescribes, hands you the prescription, and on the prescription it says, take two twice a day, right? But at the same time that you're being handed the written prescription, the doctor is saying, this may make you nauseous. If it does, take it in the morning, take it in the evening, try it with milk, try it with a meal, try it before a meal, right? There's a lot of oral instruction that goes along at the same time that you're handing it over, right? They're part and parcel of the same thing. So you need the written, but the oral is different because for you, you might be nauseous if you take it in the morning and not at night, or in the night and not in the morning, or you might be lactose intolerant. So have it with milk doesn't work for you, but have it with a meal does, right? So there's all of that. It's the expansion on. The point is get you healthy, right? So, but the method is written and oral, and then you have to put it together. So you get how that works so far? Okay, so Kabbalah is a third level, right? So we got the written Torah and the oral Torah at the same time. By the way, what is the oral Torah? Who knows? This is a question you can answer.
It's what the Moses handed off to everyone, and then they handed off person to person, rabbi to learn.
Okay, that's a chain of transmission. Mm-hmm. So what we have, what. Where it's held today, it's supposed to be held just in the mouths of the sages and taught over. So I would be a small, tiny link in the chain of teaching it over. I don't hold it all. But the book that it's held in today is the Talmud. Now, it's just held in that book as a container because it's still oral. It's not supposed to be written down. It did have to, at some point, be written down as a container, only, so that it could be transferred from generation to generation. It was shortly after the destruction of the Second Temple that was understood prophetically that this was going to be an extremely long exile and difficult and dark, and we would be at serious risk of losing the oral transmission. So notes were taken to stimulate discussion that would keep it alive. So the Talmud are those notes. It's not that the Talmud, the way it is written, was handed over at Sinai like this. At Sinai, this was written, and we got it just like that, and we have it just like that still today. But the oral transmission was not. It's not what's written in the Talmud. What's written in the Talmud is the container that holds the whole thing. And the example that I often use for that, you may have heard me say this before, but I'll repeat it, because it's a good... The Talmud opens with a question and an answer. Right, so the question that it opens with is, from what time do we read Kriyat Shema in the evening? And the answer is, from the time that the Kohanim go in to eat their truma. Okay, everybody understand the question and the answer? No, right? Because you have to know, what is Kriyat Shema? Why do we say it? Who are the Kohanim? What is truma? Under what circumstances do they eat it? Right, so you can't understand the question or the answer without a teacher.
Is every Talmud just like the Torah? Are they exactly the same? You know, how they scribe the Torah?
No, it's not all the same. It's mostly the same. So we have two versions. First of all, we have the Jerusalem Talmud and the Babylonian Talmud. Sometimes the Jerusalem Talmud is called the Palestinian Talmud. So we have those two. The authoritative version is the Babylonian version, because that's where the bulk of the scholars were in Babylon after the destruction of the First Temple. They were exiled to Babylon. Seminaries were set up there, which were maintained until about the year 1000 after the destruction, the year 1000 of our current count. And actually, the Babylonian community remained until just a few years ago, when I think there's one or two left now, Jews altogether. It's not a minion. But it's been since the destruction of the First Temple till a few years ago. Anyway, that's the authoritative version. And that version, so the Palestinian one, the Jerusalem one, is quite different. Similar. It's still a container. If you understand it as a container. It is only a container. So it's not necessary that the words be the same. And we don't necessarily study it in the same way at all. At all. Whereas this, we look at every word and every vowel even. Every letter is a vav there or not there. Do you hear it or see it? It makes a difference in the written law. It's not the same at all in the oral law. The oral law is meant to be a container. That being said, however, it was finally, and then because of the travels, as you would expect, certain things, and because it's hand copied, right? Sometimes people made mistakes. Sometimes people added in notes. Sometimes, if somebody would be taking notes in the margins, the scribe who would transcribe would add the notes right in, right? So there were many different copies. So there were scholars. Trying to remember who was the main one recently, but approximately 250, 300 years ago, there was a scholar who went through Europe for years. Somebody who had a photographic memory, and he went and compared different volumes and created a redacted, perfected, not perfect, because we don't have perfect in this kind of thing, but created basically the version that's supposed to be our version. And finally, with the invention of the printing press, it had been printed many times, but even the printed versions, there were many differences. But finally, we came to the Vilna printing press and the Vilna, the way it's organized, and that's the page that we see today. So the page that we see today, the way it's printed, the way it's set up, is now the standard and is the way all of them are printed today. And the reason for that is because people who have photographic memories memorize exactly where on the page that piece of information is. And also all notes would refer to the Talmud Bavli, page 36, A or B. Right? So the first side and the second side, because each page, it's one full page has the same number, and it's A or B side. So in order to not mess that up, you can't now reprint it. You can't reset it. It's set that way. Which means also that some of the things that were taken out, some of the things that the Christians required us to remove, some references to Jesus or some references to certain things that they felt uncomfortable with, or so some things that we can now put back because it's safe are only put back in the back of the edition so it won't mess up the whole system of reference and printing. So Right, so it's not at all the same as the written. It's just that's why it's important, and that's why I use the word container. It is the container for the oral law. It itself is not the oral law. It just holds it. It's sort of like a set of notes that reminds the teacher how to teach it and is the vehicle through which teacher passes it on to students. So there is a methodology of learning it. But basically, it's the oral law is the instructions that make the written law work. So that's how you can see it. So the whole point of everything is to get the Jew connected to God. How to use the physical world to connect the soul to God. That's the point of it all. Right? So the Torah is how to use the physical world to connect to God. And the oral law is how to do all that stuff that the Torah says to do. How to actually make it work. And Kabbalah is much more of the theory, the whys and how it works. You don't need Kabbalah to make it work. That's sort of like the pharmacology in our doctor illusion, right? So you need the prescription, and you need how to make it work in your life, but you don't have to understand how it works in your body, right? Mm-hmm. That's what Kabbalah is, how it works. So it's interesting to understand that, but it's not necessary to understand that unless you want to start concocting your own medicine. Right? Then you need to know that. But in order to know that, you need to know a lot, because it can get quite risky, as we know from meth labs and things. It can get quite explosive when you try to concoct your own medicine without actually all the knowledge you've added to it. So all these are just analogies. Don't take them literally, clearly. But the point is, the more you know, the better job you can do. So it's enough for most of us, and it's a lifelong study, to get written and oral. Right, and learn how to do it, how to use the physical world to connect our souls to Hashem. That's what we want to do. Right? But Kabbalah is that interesting, deeper layer, and I think particularly today, more people are interested in that. We want to know that. Now, Madonna comes into the picture, Madonna et al., that whole group, because they want Kabbalah without Torah and without the oral law. It's just about how could I feel a spiritual something without the package of Judaism, mm-hmm. right? Which it can't work. You can't do Kabbalah or apply it at all without the vessel of Torah in your life. So the mitzvot, really, halacha, all Jewish law creates, now here's another way of using the word container, all of that creates the container for your soul's best growth. That's the contents of the container. So, but you have to have a container, because without the container, there's no place to store the contents. So contents being the spiritual yearnings, strivings, and accomplishments, right? So let's say New Age philosophy, right? I happen to be raised by a nouveau Christian New Age mom kind of thing. Great person, but the whole religion, right, whatever. Anyway, so I have quite a bit of relationship with New Age stuff. Okay, so...
But I see in the New Age realm... Hi. You might find her in here. You want to bring her back? Or?
Yeah.
Okay, great. You can come in if you want. I just need to close the door for noise. Okay.
Anyway, so I have observed in the New Agey type of community where people are very earnest and want to grow very much, that often the growth is comes from a program or a place, but then can be undirected or spill into different places or over the years not necessarily achieve goals such as controlling anger or not being jealous or fixing the world or fixing relationships or living in loving relationships that are committed and permanent and stuff like that, that often that can't grow without a container to hold it. So that's what the container is about. Halacha, I have also seen in the Orthodox Jewish world, people who build a very strong container and have no clue what to do with that container and don't bother filling it or don't even know how to fill it or don't put the effort into filling it. So people are very careful about law but haven't built a relationship at all inside of it. Mm-hmm. So they're kind of, they could be it. So that you could have empty containers, you could have content spilling. Really what you want is this nice solid container with contents in it. And the more contents you want, the stronger container you have to build. And so there should be a relationship between filling it with contents and building a container. The container built through keeping Jewish law, and the contents come as a byproduct of the building and the striving. How that all works, again, is the science of Kabbalah. So today, I think there is quite a bit of interest in Kabbalah. I don't recommend, I'm just mentioning it because I shouldn't recommend, but it was fascinating, the book, The Autobiography of a Yogi. So that book is credited with having brought Eastern philosophy to the West, I think in the 1930s. It is a fascinating and probably forbidden exposition of Hindu philosophy in woven into the memoir. It is his actual memoir of this yogi and then philosophy woven in, teaching it through his life and examples. So I read it actually listen to it, narrated by Ben Kingsley. It was interesting to listen. But I listened to it because I had a student who was interested in that, a Jewish student, and I wanted to help her see that there's a lot of that in Judaism, but I need to learn more. Having listened to that, I see there's so much Kabbalah in Hinduism, just like there's so much Jewish value in Christianity, but there are twists and bastardizations and incorrect divergences that go on. It's definitely there in both, but it was fascinating to see. Bless you.
Thank you.
Also, some people feel that Kabbalah is relatively new. Meditation in Judaism often sounds like that's a contradiction. And yet we have a deep meditative tradition, but we have kind of a large break. So really the prophets and the schools of prophecy that existed in the First Temple and before that, and in the First Temple and slightly spilling over into the period in between the two temples, with prophecy then ending, the era of prophecy ended with the beginning of the Second Temple. But before that, there were schools of prophecy. So, school for prophecy? Isn't it just God, like, talks to you, a light shines on you, and in comes the information, and then you just tell the world? No, in fact, turns out you have to prepare yourself to be somebody who can channel that information. And so there is a whole long process of preparation and then ability to connect in different ways. And some prophecies were given to be shared with others and some not. So there were millions of prophets, it turns out, at that time. We only have recorded that which is important to us today. So prophecies for posterity. But the concept of prophets and why they would be there, you might ask, why have a prophet and prophecy if it's not meant for the long term? Maybe it's just meant to correct that generation, but it's even more than that, because the whole concept of prophecy altogether is about creating a vehicle in a human being to have an extra strong connection with God. And since we are all linked as human beings, since we all share one soul root, one person achieving that deep connection feeds spiritually all people. So, and certainly all Jews. So you would want to create an environment in which more people could achieve prophecy to create a spiritual stream that nurtures everyone, even those who are not in striving to achieve that.
Wow. That is so,
so
cool.
That's what it is, right?
As the leaders of the generation, similar, right? I mean, I think in a way it could be similar, but not. This is just a parable. It's similar to science. Not all of us are scientists, but we certainly support all of our middle schoolers, all of our high schoolers take a lot of science, more than they need for life, right? All the science they take, really, our whole program as a country is to expose everyone to science in case somebody's really turned on by it. And hopefully some cream will rise, and they'll become our scientists. And it's really important to have high-level science going on, because it feeds all of us, because we all walk around with fabulous cell phones today, where we can talk to everybody by bouncing messages off of satellites and talk in real time, even face pictures, to places across the globe, right? Because we took biology in sixth grade. Right? So not really, but the point is we need to have people who are on a high level. They feed us all, right? So just a parable, but similarly, you could see how spiritually prophets could feed us all. Okay, so that's what Kabbalah is. Okay, so what is the text of Kabbalah? Anybody know? The Zohar. Excellent. What does Zohar mean?
Bright.
Bright. Right. It means bright, brilliant.
Glow.
Glow, yeah.
Glow.
Mm-hmm. Right. So it's the concept of light. Torah also means light. In general, it means law. But the root inside is or, light. Right? So if we're supposed to be a light unto the nations, where do we get that light? The more Torah we absorb, the more we can shine. But if we want to be super shiny, we would want Zohar too. Right? Zohar is, like the Talmud, the container of Kabbalah. It is not Kabbalah, but it is the container of it. It's extremely difficult to read. It's not something I've ever attempted. I don't think I've even looked anything up in it. I've looked things up in the Talmud. I am not skilled at Talmudic study, but I've certainly looked up references. But in the Zohar, I don't think I've even looked up a reference. Nevertheless, that's the book, and just need to know, that's the book of Kabbalah is the Zohar, the main text. However, from that emanate, in the light spectrum, many different, much more accessible texts. So for today, if anybody's interested in looking into a little bit, I would recommend the works of Rabbi Akiva Tatz and Rabbi Aryeh Kaplan. So Kaplan for deeper, Tatz for easier to access, although Kaplan also excellent for ease of access. We have a concept of translator, which is one that made me feel much more comfortable with teaching, I have to say. I read in the beginning of Rabbi Shimshon Pinkus's book on prayer, he said, how do I come to write a book on prayer? I mean, there's so many great people who have written so much. I should write a book on prayer. He was a great rabbi. He unfortunately died recently. He said, who am I to write? He said, I'm not writing my own ideas. All I'm doing is translating the ideas of the greats into the language of today. That's what this book is. So there, we need translators. So I feel like as a teacher, it's not, sometimes it's my own ideas, but in general, I'm just translating ideas of people I've read, things I've been exposed to, into language that can be understood in 2011, just a translator. So Rabbi Kaplan was a master translator. Master. He probably had access to deeper things too, and there are some of his own things in there, but he was a master translator. He died very young, as many Kabbalists do, it turns out. I think the higher brilliance and burning the bulb at higher voltage uses up the life energy faster. We often see that with very brilliant Kabbalists. They often live very short lives. So Rabbi Kaplan is also a PhD, I think, in physics, and he died, I think, at age 48. But he wrote prolifically. I mean, maybe 50 books. I mean, just unbelievable. Just prolifically. And he translated also, amazingly. So you'll see his translations, Aryeh Kaplan's translations. I'm sure you've all seen the purple living Torah that has green leaves on it, purple cover with green leaves. He translated that. And according to one of my teachers, Rabbi Joel Unger, he said it's almost translated prophetically, almost Ruach HaKodesh, that he knew how to translate things. It's translated to be very readable, but it's integrated with all the commentaries. Anyway, so there's his works, and he has many, not all of which are easy to read, because some of them are on deeper things. And you can even look him up on YouTube and hear a little bit. Here you can. It's amazing. YouTube's amazing. You can hear some interviews and some discussions that he has, and even some meditations that he leads are on YouTube. And then Rabbi Akiva Tatz, so you can find a lot of his classes on simpletoremember.com, and probably Akiva Tatz has his own site, I'm guessing. but he has lots of recordings that are fascinating to listen to, where he talks about deeper aspects of the world and how it works. But he has great books, World Mask and Living Inspired, which really take you kind of behind the scenes a little bit to see how things work, how time works, how inspiration works, how humility works, how silence works, those kinds of things. Okay, so that being said, now we know the container, right? Now let's go a speck Kabbalistic. Okay, so we'll get into it, just to the drops of the beginnings of Kabbalah. So how is it that this world exists? Right? So if God is everything and everywhere, how are we here? Right? It's really a question. Because if God fills everything, how could there be room for anything else? So one of the primary Kabbalistic concepts is Tzimtzum, contraction. God had to get himself out of the way to create space, so to speak. And I do not understand how this works. This is where the not being a capitalist shows up. How could God get himself out of the way to create space? And yet God did. So that's what we're taught. He contracted, got it, contracted itself into itself to create a vacuum. So the first thing that was created was space. And then into that vacuum of space, a thread of light was spun. And that thread of light that was spun, so it all comes from light, right? So imagine the thread of light in the vacuum, and then it had to emanate out and eventually, through the emanations, go through enough changing stations of energy to manifest us. So how did that work? So the us actually comes a little bit later in the process. But in the beginning, so there were the switching stations of energy. So the energy had to be diluted and then diluted again and transformed and diluted again, much like energy from a nuclear power plant to a cell phone has to be diluted multiple times through all those switching stations of electrical power stations, that from the power generator to the high voltage ones that we see with, you know, barbed wire and above it so that we can't access it, all the way, you know, down the road to the high voltage things on the power lines, to the smaller ones behind our house, to the box on the outside of our house, to the box on the inside of our house, to the outlet, to the little box we plug into the outlet to reduce it further, to go through that little thin cord to get into our phone, right? So there's many different reductions of power before it can be usable. So the light that was spun had to be reduced many times before it could be made manifest into the initial creation. Now, the initial creation, and this is based on the book by the Ramchal, Rabbi Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, called Derech Hashem. The initial creation was a creature, mankind, the whole world, first of all, was created, and the heavens and the earth and everything that's in it, and the whole, you've read the beginning of Genesis, so you know how everything was all set up. Final creature, mankind, right? But that final creature, mankind, was physical, but initially was created out of light, was a light body. So we know that light is physical. I don't know enough physics to go far there, but light is physical, right? Light in Hebrew is or, right? So after the first sin, after Adam and Eve ate whatever fruit it was that they ate, which for sure wasn't an apple, but might have been grapes, and it might have been wheat, and it might have been those few different things of what it was. Apple is not in the Jewish consciousness at all. But whatever it is they ate, and the incorporation of negativity into them, completely transformed the physicality of the world, of the cosmos, of the spiritual realms, and of man himself. So that then, as you know from reading the beginning, we had to be covered in garments, right? God made us garments of what? We made the garments of leaves, right? Adam and Eve took the fig leaf, but God made them garments of?
Flesh and bone.
Of skin. So you might think leather, right? Think cave person, leather garments, right? But it's this leather. We transformed from or to or. Or in Hebrew with an aleph is light, and or in Hebrew with an ayin is skin. So it sounds the same, but it's spelled differently. And we switched into these heavy, thick, clumpy bodies of skin that have a whole different way of relating to the world. That's one of the secrets in what we do at Havdalah, right? We do, when we light the candle of Havdalah, we go like this. Right? Have you seen people do that? So what are they doing there? So first, you're looking at light and dark, right? The difference between the two. But then also, you're looking at the shine on your fingernails, the shine from the flame in your fingernails. That shine from the flame in your fingernails reminds us of the early light that we accessed before we became like this. We were mostly like this. Our fingernails are the last, the thing that's closest on our bodies to what we used to look like. We weren't hard like our fingernails, but we were see-through, translucent like our fingernails, whatever that means, right? So my son, my 21-year-old, hates it when people say, whatever that means. He's like, whatever that means. That just gets you out of trying to explain what it is and what it does mean. Whatever that means. But I still have to say whatever that means because we don't know what it means, right? We never saw bodies like that. However, I think we could imagine like kind of a ghosty type of a thing. Like, you know, people have seen either movies or maybe in real life themselves, depending on your experiences. But we could at least conjure up the image of a ghost that's like sort of a light body that can pass through a wall or something, but that is a body of light. So that's sort of more what we were like initially. And the philosophers take us in long directions through Kabbalistic strains into how that light body interacted with the soul. And it's a different interaction today now with these flesh bodies. Any questions up to here so far? Yeah.
I don't want to derail the whole conversation, but why?
That's a great question. And I'll practice my answer that I'm teaching. I now teach young Rebbetzins how to teach, right? So this is a sentence I gave them. That's a great question. And it deserves a long answer. And we don't have time for that answer right now. So I'll refer you to the book Derech Hashem. It's really, I mean, I could give you a short answer, but it wouldn't do justice to it. So it's a great question. Why is a great question? And let's just hold that as a question for now. Because what I have learned is that questions are best kept, developed, and then properly answered. So it's a great question. But you're right, it would derail everything.
Maybe you can answer why not.
No, it's much longer than that. You can answer as a Jew for sure, why not? Because, you know, we do answer questions with questions. That's the thing. But, right. 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 Okay, so we have this contraction of God, the Tzimtzum, and we have this thread of light, and we have the many different switching stations. What are those switching stations called? They're called spherot, realms. Sphere in English is round, and that's what a sphera is also in Hebrew, a round thing, an environment, a sphere. It could also be a sapphire, it's the same root. It could also be a story, saper, to tell something, or counting, to enumerate something. It's interesting when you think about stories and counting, they're two opposite things. It's the same root. The story is taking the thing and making it go and go and go, tell the story, right? And counting is saying this is what it is. It chops it off into little pieces. Right, so the same root is to cut it up. Also, lisaper is to cut hair. Misparaim is scissors. It's all the same root. Right, so it's a fascinating root. It means to cut and it means to expand. And it means an environment. Also, all of that together in the one root. So, the spherot. So, a Kabbalistic principle that we have is that there are 7 spherot, really 10 spherot. We often talk about the 7 lower ones, which is what we'll discuss today, but just a quick nod to the 3 upper ones. The 3 upper ones are often, they have different names, but commonly 3 of them are called Chachma, Bina, and Dat. Those 3 represent 3 different kinds of knowledge. Chachma, a chacham, right, somebody smart, kind of book knowledge. Bina is women's intuition or understanding things within their context. And Dat is totally integrated knowledge, connection with the material in a deep way. Those 3 together, Chachma, Bina, and Dat, form the acronym Chabad, which is what the Lubavitchers took as their acronym for their movement, Chabad. It comes from those 3 upper spherot. Now let's go to the 7 lower one. The 3 upper one are considered much more intellectual, spiritual, the intellect and the spirit, very mixed in Jews and in Jewish tradition and understanding. Also, just as a nod to Hanukkah coming up, we're all about the mixing and preserving and empowering of the spirit through the intellect. So part of the battle over Hanukkah was, what's really important, the intellect or the spirit through the intellect? Right? So the Greek, and then hence Western philosophy, is very much education, 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 for the sake of education. And even we Jews can sometimes fall into education for the sake of education. Certainly secular Jews, my son the doctor, all comes from that, right? Why do you want a son the doctor? Because he's the most educated you could be at those times when you would say, my son the doctor, with an accent, you know. So it's the biggest thing, right? The most educated. So because education for the sake of education, but that's not the Jewish thing, education for the sake of education. It's education for the sake of connection, for the sake of soul growth. Right? So the whole Hanukkah battle was over. We Jews love education. And we thought that Greek culture was stunningly beautiful, which it is, except for it ends at education and doesn't take it into where you're supposed to go with it. But the two are very mixed, which is why the Greek exile was an exile in our own land. Right? We weren't thrown out of our land. It was the exile of the intellect. And so the intellect was darkened by Greek philosophy, which is why we light candles to lighten it back up, to relight, show the intellect shining, which is why we required pure olive oil, which represents the pure Jewish intellect, not the tainted Greek intellect that was infecting us, but we rather wanted the pure light to be able to light the world up through pure and untainted Jewish intellect, not tainted by Greek values. That being said, okay, now let's look at the lower sphirot, those seven. So I'll give you the... Do I have a board? No, not really. Over there. But nothing to write on. So I'll just have to tell you.
I can get you markers if you want.
No.
They make you some of the drawers.
Yeah. That way. Do you want to No, it's okay. I'll tell you what they are. I'm sure you've all seen probably a tree, and you could look this up, but sometimes they're drawn as a tree. Sometimes they're equated to parts of the body, but usually they look like a circle, circle in the middle, two more circles, and then two circles on the bottom. Has everybody seen that kind of a chart before? So it's two, one, two, two. You have a picture in there of that? I probably handed it out at some point in the past. Yes. Yes, I did hand that out one time in the past. Okay. So that's got the upper three also. That's upside down. Yeah. That way. Yeah. That's got the upper three also. But let's just look at the bottom seven. So it's two and then a center, two and then a center going down once. Okay. So that's your seven. Thank you. So you have Chesed and Gvura, Tiferet. So we'll start with those three. And each one of them also parallels one of the seven shepherds of Israel, our seven forefathers. Right? So chesed, loving kindness, is one of the sphirot. Right? It's the first one. And that is embodied by Avraham. It's the flow of loving kindness. It's an external flow going out and flowing into kindness. Right? Then that's on the right side. On the left side, which is considered the severe side, you have gevura, strength or boundaries, right? The cutting off of things. That's embodied by Yitzchak, Isaac, who was able to allow himself to be bound on the altar. It's not even considered to be one of his tests, right? He was so clear on his mission and what needed to be done to sanctify God's name. It wasn't even considered. Imagine, he was 37 years old, allowing himself his hands to be tied and laid on the altar, waiting to be killed. It's not counted as his test. It's Abraham's test, because Abraham is man of chesed. How does a person of chesed, loving kindness, kill their child? How is that possible? Right? It's his test. Right? So, and part of the test, just to whet your appetite for further study, is that really in order for Abraham to do that, he had to not just give up his son and his future and his position in society where he had been teaching no human sacrifice and it's wrong, 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 and now he's about to do it. So he's not just giving up his son, his future, his pulpit, his influence, his reputation, but he's giving up his God. Because how could God do that? How could he say it? And if he would do it, he'd be severing the relationship. So it's a fascinating thing to be, you know, what his test was, but it wasn't Isaac's, because he was a man of strength and of boundaries. Blended together, those two, the flow and the cutting, we have Tiferet in the middle, which is harmony or blend, and that's represented in Yaakov and Jacob, that he was the blend of those two. So the blend, for instance, let's say Chesed is rain, right? We need precipitation to flow. What happens if we don't get enough rain? Right? So then the crops don't grow. What happens if we get too much rain? Right? So then we have flooding. So the kindness, the goodness of rain has to have the right boundary. Has to be cut at the right time to make it useful to us, right? So all kindness has to be cut at the right place to make it useful to the person who's receiving it or useful to the world that's receiving it. So that the usefulness is the cutting, but the blend of the two, the flow and the cut that blends nicely, that's Tiferet, and that's represented in our forefather Jacob. Now we go to Moses and Aaron, Netzach and Hod. Those two are connected also when you do the whole thing to body parts, and I don't know exactly where the other ones connect, but these two connect to the kidneys. They're twins, these two aspects, and sometimes they're reversed, sometimes they're on the other side of the scale. Usually right is for flow and ease, and left in general is for the cutting and the severe traits. So, but not so with Netzach and Hod, which I'll explain in a minute. They could be on either side, but in general it's Netzach and then Hod. So Netzach is eternity, the concept of eternity, and that's represented by Moses, who gave us the Torah, which is eternal, and us connecting to the Torah, connecting to that Eitz Chaim, that tree of life, brings us from the tree of death, where we incorporated death into the world through eating that fruit. We can now reverse the process of being mortal people to become immortal by grabbing onto the tree of life in the Torah. Right? So that's Moses, who brought us the antidote to the death is life. Right? And then Aaron, who was the lover of peace and pursuer of peace, you know, he was known for getting people to make up from arguments. He would go to one and say, you know, Bob really said about you that he's really sorry he said that, and he thinks you're really great. And he'd go over to Sam and say, you know, Sam. And they would talk back and forth. And then they would be able to apologize because he would help smooth the way. So he was known as a lover of peace, a pursuer of peace, and he's a Kohen, peace also being wholeness and completion. The Kohen is the one who is the mediator of the relationship, or was the facilitator, not mediator, but the facilitator of the relationship between the whole body of Israel and God. Not that we need one for individual relationship, but for a collective, sometimes collective relationship, and creating the environment for spiritual growth. That's Aaron. So that's Hod. Hod is splendor. Difficult to translate, but that's splendor. So he's about splendor, really about everything functioning the way it should be functioning, the shine that comes from that. That's Hod. That's Aaron. Next comes a middle one. Number six on our list is Yesod, and that is foundation. That is embodied in Joseph. Joseph, the only man in the entire Torah that's described as beautiful, because that was important to him. Right, he was 17 years old in the house of Potiphar, and he was beautiful, and he was chaste. So any guy here remembers what it was like being 17. Any girl here remembers what it was like knowing guys at 17, right? They're like one big ball of hormones, right? And so he was a big, beautiful ball of hormones, right, who was being pursued by his master's wife, right? How difficult is it to not succumb to that? And she tried in so many different ways and finally had the whole house cleared. So it was just the two of them. All the other servants, everybody else was gone. Apparently there was some kind of sun festival for the sun god down by the river, and everybody was gone. It was just the two of them, and she cornered him, and he almost succumbed when he was able to conjure up the image of his father and take off, and she was left holding his cloak. He even had to like disrobe himself to be able to run away. Then she cried rape, and nobody said, well, if he was raping you, why are you holding his cloak? Looks like maybe he ran instead of you, right? But nevertheless, the fact that he was able to withstand her advances and to channel his sexual energy appropriately is the foundation of the ability to channel all energy. The ability to channel one's sexual energy is the foundation. So it's number six, foundation, yesod. The foundation of channeling of all of our energies, really what makes us human, the ability to transcend instinct, right? We all have instinct that works in us like it does in other animals, and the ability to not go with that is uniquely human. So he was able to do that, and to not go with a sexual instinct is the foundation of being able to not go with any instinct, with anger, with hunger, with desire for somebody else's property. If you can withstand that most primal instinct, you could try to transcend other ones too. So that's the foundation of it all. That's Yosef, and that's number six. And finally, we have number seven, which is embodied by King David, Malchut, Majesty. It's the manifestation of all these other energies, all flow down. We live in this lower world of Malchut. of majesty, where we're supposed to live in a way that shows the majesty of God. So, which is why we're called a Mamlechet Kohanim v'Goy Kadosh. We're a holy nation, a Mamlechet Kohanim, a priestly nation, Goy Kadosh, and a holy people. Right. So, but that means all of us are Kohanim. Whether we're Kohen, Levi, Israel, male, female, young, old, we're all Kohanim. It's our job to facilitate the relationship of the entire world, all humanity, with God. That's who we're supposed to be. Right? And we do that through holiness, and we do that through how we behave in our life. And the book, really, going back to the top of the list, the written Torah, is what teaches us how to behave that way, how to use the physical world in order to create that soul connection, both for ourselves, and then to shine the light so that other people will see it, and also be able to engage in that relationship. Any questions so far? Just take a breath. Okay. So, those are the seven sefirot. So that's a classic Kabbalistic construct. Parenthetically, so God created the world through those seven sefirot, and parenthetically, the Kala, the bride, walks around her groom seven times. You've probably seen that under the chuppah, where she walks around. So what is she doing there? She's walking around seven times because it is, in general, the wife's role to create the environment in which the family lives, in which the husband lives. So it's also a sexual illusion. He lives inside of her, and she creates that circle around him. But it's also a wider illusion that Ishto Kebeto, his wife, is like his home. He lives in her, but he lives in the environment that she creates. So just as Hashem created the world through these seven sefirot, she takes upon creating that environment with the seven sefirot around him. So she sort of starts at that point weaving the environment around her husband that she will take responsibility for creating in their home, which is represented by the chuppah above them. It's representative of their home. So she begins taking on her role by walking with those seven circles around. Okay, all that being said, so we talked about Tzimtzum, so that God got out of the way so that we could exist, and then he used that thread of light, and he created through those sefirot, he was able to dilute the light so it could become manifest into this world. Now what happens? He actually had to get out of the way twice for us. Once physically, and once emotional, spiritually, in a way, however you want to call that, in order to create free will, in order to give us free will. Because God's will should run everything, right? Nothing can exist without God willing it. So if God's will is all pervasive, which it is, how then could our free will exist? So God had to move his will out of the way to create space for our will to exist. If we have free will, it means we can choose good and choose bad, right? So, and that's a whole another class, which I can't remember if we did here. I think we probably talked about together free will and stuff like that. Anyway, so... Pardon?
It's year one.
Year one, right. So it's hard to know with different classes what I spoke to which class about what. But anyway, I think we did talk about free will. So free will, part of there being a meaningful free will means there has to be negativity to choose from. There is, of course, positivity, but there has to be negative too. And so God created negative for us to be able to choose or to choose away from. So the initial Garden of Eden concept, there's the whole garden, it's all fabulous, eat from all the trees except for that one over there, don't eat that one. It was the whole negative commandment, that was it. Eat from everything, just not that one. One choice to make, that's all we had to do. Just one. Right? At that point, the choice was a rocket-powered choice. And it could either, if we would have made the proper choice, choosing not to eat from that, brought all of humanity into total perfection, in the end of days, because that's all we needed was to make that positive choice. Or the same rocket-powered choice, chosen negatively, could change everything and mess up the entire world, which it did, because they made the wrong choice. That's called Shvirat HaKelim, the breaking of the vessels in Kabbalistic terms. The whole world was set up, nicely balanced, all the vessels holding the different aspects of light, and Humanity resting in the middle, the whole purpose of creation is humanity. And now the wait and see moment, right? Of course, Hashem is above time, so he knew what would happen. But still, for us, in living in linear time, the wait and see moment, what decision will be made? Will we bring all of this to perfection or not? So the answer was not. So the whole thing was completely transformed. So the vessels in the upper realms were all broken, and the light spilled all around. Kabbalistically, that's where we get the sparks from. Probably heard about gathering sparks, right? Have you heard of that concept sometimes in literature or in different places in Jewish art? Gathering sparks. Where did the sparks come from? It came from the breaking of the vessels, where the light that was in them, and this was a light way beyond this kind of light, but there was a special light that was held of too powerful for this world, was broken apart. Sparks flew everywhere, and sparks became integrated into different aspects of the world. And gathering the sparks is part of what we're doing. It's one of the reasons why we have the exile that we have, with Jews being spread everywhere throughout all the nations, because there are lots of sparks to be gathered. Sparks in cultures, and sparks on continents, and sparks in material things, and sparks in intellectual ideas, and sparks in science, and sparks in literature, and sparks in philosophy, and sparks in art, and sparks in people. All those sparks have to be gathered. And in a way, we Jews are sparks magnets. So as we move through, we start to gather up those sparks. We increase our magnetism by the more Torah that we keep. We make ourselves into more powerful spark gatherers. But we want to gather those sparks and eventually fix that which was broken. So what was broken is the world. And that's what tikkun olam is. Tikkun olam is fixing the world. Right? So you have to lift yourself out of probably what many of you have heard in terms of reform and conservative philosophy, especially in reform, about it being political or civil or just positive action, writing stones in cemeteries and pulling weeds and feeding the poor, and that being called tikkun olam. That can be part of the steps in tikkun olam, but that itself is not tikkun olam. Tikkun olam means fixing that which was broken by that initial sin of Adam and Chava together. All the things that they broke have to first be fixed. And once we get back to zero, because we're way below, we have to bring ourselves up to that place where it's fixed. And from there, then try to jump back into our potential to bring humanity back into that connection. So that's what tikkun olam is bringing it all back together. So you could see how certainly being kind, doing acts of chesed, or strengthening your boundaries, or working on blends, or trying to delve into eternity, or into splendor, or into foundation, or into manifesting majesty, all of those... Hi.
Anitra's mother. She's in the... Hello. Sorry.
Okay. I'm just wrapping up.
Oh, no problem. You're just wrapping up, did you say?
Yes, I am just wrapping
because
up.
Because he can stay with her then.
Oh, okay. Because it would just like 5 more minutes.
Okay, that's fine.
Okay, great.
He'll just be right here in the lobby, okay?
Okay.
Okay.
Great. Thanks. Okay, so all of those... What was I saying now? Are... fixing the world, right? So all of those physical ways are ways that we can engage, use the physical, right? That's what the whole Torah is about. How do we use the physical to create soul connections? So tikkun olam projects are how do we use the physical to create a soul connection, right? But it shouldn't devolve into just how do we do good things, but it's how to use the physical to create a soul connection. That's what tikkun olam is. How do we use this world? How do we fix this world? How do we use who we are and what we have to engage in the world to bring it back to the place of repair so that we can there from there jump off? Meanwhile, inside of all of our tikkun olam, part of what we need to be doing is emulating God. So a strong aspect of emulating God is creating space. So God created space for us to live in physically and in terms of our free will, right? He got his will out of the way, he got his self out of the way so that we could live here physically and emotionally and with our free will. So then it's up to us to create space inside us for God to live in us. God created space in him for us to live in him, and to emulate God, we can create space in us in us for him to live in us. So that is the verse that we may have discussed before, but I'm sure Rabbi Levin has, that where it says, build for me a tabernacle and I will dwell. It should be in it, right? But it's not. It's in you, right? So what is that, right? Build for me a tabernacle and I'll dwell in you. How do you use the physical world? Use the physical world by building this thing with all its intricate pieces. But really what I want you to be doing is build space inside you, create space inside you so I could live inside you. How do you create that space? By engaging physically in the world. It's not just meditation. It is engagement. It is mitzvah involvement. You have to be physical. Do physical things to create the spiritual space. But ultimately, the point is to create the space, just as God created space for us to live in him, we can create space inside us for him to live inside us. And there you go. I finished on time. Yes. Okay. Any questions you want to ask?
That was kind of amazing.
Yeah, how many breaths did you take? Got a lot out.
Learn how to talk fast. I'm a New Yorker. Not really, but I lived there for 16 years, so I've got the New York, you know, speed. So
if Kabbalah is the how, it's the why in the how?
It's the why. Why and the what, sort of.
Why and the what, and the Torah is the how.
Well, the Torah is what you're supposed to be accomplishing, and the Kabbalah is how it works. The pharmacology of it, spiritual pharmacology. Thanks. Really, I think that's the best way to look at it, the how it works. But you don't need to know to make it work.
Right.
You just need to know what to do to make it work best in your life. That's Torah.
Right.
Sheva'al Peh and Torah Shebichtav, written and oral Torah, and how they interact together. How to make it work. How to engage in the physical world to make it work so that you have a way to create spiritual self-life. Right, so how to make it work. Kabbalah is how that works. Which you don't have to know to make it work. But can be pleasant to know. Right?
Yeah.
Right.
Pretty cool.
Okay. All very good.